Support for the morning show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. Support for the morning show also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I am very excited about part one of today's morning show because it's a chance to reconnect with an extraordinarily talented and entertaining pianist by the name of Jason Lyle Black. And speaking of talented pianists, also in the room here is Eric Carlson, who I'm sure many of you know for his various musical exploits here in southeastern Wisconsin. Somehow or another, and I don't remember how, Eric and Jason are friends, know each other well, and Eric has brought Jason Lyle Black here to town on at least one previous occasion, and Jason is back appearing in several different area schools and also playing tomorrow night in a house concert at the home of Jeff Neubauer in Racine. And it is a home concert that will be a benefit event for the Racine Theater Guild. And it's a chance for people to experience the extraordinary talents of Jason Lyle Black in person. Jason Lyle Black has some of the most popular videos on YouTube, and he has appeared on all kinds of national television programs and so on. He's often known as the backwards pianist because he does this incredible trick where he sits at the bench and plays the piano that is behind him. I mean, with his hands behind his back, and contorts himself in order to just sort of give this seamless performance. It's like nothing I've ever seen anybody do. And he's also a wonderful entertainer, and his act includes wonderful stories about some of his experiences as a pianist. It's just an all-around gifted performer, and it's great to have him back in our studios along with Eric. We welcome both of you back to the morning show.
Thanks, Greg.
Thanks for having us, Greg.
Great. So, Eric, tell us the story. How do you know Jason Lyle Black?
Well, we first met, I think, through Facebook, where I saw one of his YouTube videos. And we, you know, messaged each other and talked about the possibility of, you know, what might happen from that. And I think it was at that time Jason was starting to do some school assembly type concerts during the school day to inspire the kids and that kind of thing, and wanted to use that and do more of that type of thing. And I thought, wow, what a great thing to be able to bring him here and inspire the kids in Racine and Kenosha area, and do just, you know, a bunch of school concerts during the day. And then we added to that last time he was here, and also did a headliner concert at Indian Trail Academy in their new, at that time, their new auditorium. And we did one other, we also did the house concert at Jeff Neubauer's house at that time. Mm. And that was a great success and a lot of fun to and a very intimate setting with that. It's up front and close, you know, with right. Jason kind of a thing. And so, yeah, it's been a blessing to have met Jason, and we share a lot of the same, you know, loves and things. We both compose and arrange hymns and different things like that. And so, yeah, it's been a blessing.
Wow. Now, I just assumed that you were in the same Cub Scout troop or you played baseball together in Little League or something. I mean, I had no idea it was one of these.
He's a few years younger than me, so well, that would have been impossible.
But, yeah. Right. Maybe you would have been the coach. But right. But anyway, so I did not remember that at all, that's how this connection was made. I don't know how often it works out as well as it's worked out in this
right,
case,
yeah.
But I mean, in many cases, someone ends up getting a restraining order on the person that wanted to be friends, but not in this case, I don't think. So, well, this is a great story. So, Jason, tell us a little bit about growing up and when you got bitten by the musical bug, and in particular, the piano. When did you start playing the piano?
Yeah, so I started playing when I was 8, and that's about just quite 22 years now. And then it was really about the time I was 14 or 15 that I kind of took off and piano became a passion. So at that point, I'd gotten to the point as an artist where I could play a lot of, you know, more advanced music for the piano, and starting to do the Chopin, Rachmaninoff, and and Gershwin and those kinds of really exciting pieces. And then I got really into composition at that time. And so actually it was in high school that I put out my first album about 13 years ago called Flood of Keys, which is not available. I mean, if people that have it, I guess it's a collector's item now because I don't make it commercially available. But that was something I put out myself in high school and wrote the entire album and did all that. And the passion just kind of, lit up from there. And I loved doing that. Started to get into the comedic side of music as well, doing parodies in high school. And then later in college, I had the opportunity to connect with a guy named John Schmidt, who people will know from the group The Piano Guys. That's a global touring group. So John was actually a commercial performing artist for about 15 years before The Piano Guys became a thing as a solo artist. And he was largely known in Utah and the kind of surrounding areas in the Mountain West. But anyway, so John connected and kind of mentored me as well in college. And, it's just kind of gone from there. Been a journey.
Wow. So were you, for instance, a music major in college?
So I was not, actually. I was in the business program.
Okay.
And, in fact, as I graduated from school, I went into the business field for about 3 years, worked for a large accounting firm, and was doing music still, of course, on the side. But I kind of got to the point where, as far as a career, I just thought things weren't going to work out. It's a tough business to make it in. And I did actually stop producing YouTube videos for a couple of years because I'd kind of reached a discouraging point. And then in about late 2014, just kind of got hit again with, hey, I really need to, get back into this. And so a year later, I actually quit my job as a CPA and have now been a full-time musician for a couple of years. So,
So I assume that when you started, you started in fairly standard fashion, not with any idea that you would be making music in a relatively unconventional fashion. I assume you started playing the normal etudes that everybody plays and Mozart piano sonatas and so on. At what point did your interest in the piano, at least to some extent, shift away? I mean, maybe you still play some of that sometimes, but it's obviously not the bread and butter of what you do as a professional pianist anymore. At what point did you start to shift off the more typical path of someone serious about the piano?
So that was probably a little bit about the time I was saying, kind of 14, 15, when I reached sort of a level of classical proficiency to be able to play, concertos and Rachmaninoff pieces like that, which I loved. I loved the romantic composers within the classical repertoire. That's the music that I still love to play from kind of that tradition. But that's when I really started to do the backwards piano was a routine that I developed in high school around that time. And that's when I started making some more parodies and things. And so it really kind of around the age of 15 started to take off. And then in the years since then, it's just sort of accelerated that, one of the things I do in my show is I actually do instrumental comedy at the piano. And it's something that I haven't really seen. There's tons of amazing comedians out there, but the brand I do is kind of it's a different type of routine. Mm. So you have sort of your Saturday Night Live style comedy that's the more common type of, say, musical comedy where it's, funny songs that they write and they sing or things like that. So what I actually do is I talk about, here's the songs that I would play for people's weddings when I get bored, and they're breakup songs, and you disguise them as these beautiful love songs.
Yeah, right.
And so, you tell people the songs that you're playing, and then you show them how you turned that song into this gorgeous love song, and they're like, wait, how's that?
Right.
And then, what not to play at somebody's funeral. So songs like Another One Bites the Dust, but here's how you could sneak it into somebody's funeral.
Right, by playing it in a style that could actually sneak past someone who's a little inattentive.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so there's kind of so I have various routines, and I'm starting to write a lot more, actually, as an artist in that. That's kind of where the instrumental music is actually the punchline of the joke. And
right.
It's kind of fun. So that's a passion that has sort of developed naturally over the past 4 or 5 years, just off of actual true stories of things that I would do as an artist to stay entertained. And then I started to realize, this is like a comedy routine. So now I'm kind of actively, looking at more types of things like that I can share with an audience. And – that's just sort of driven my my love of the of musical comedy. But I am still a musician, very much so. My album Piano Preludes is my most recent album, and it's my record label debut, so that's with Stone Angel Music, and I'll be performing music from that in the concerts as well, and that's very tender, you know, quiet, kind of calming music. So I sort of have two sides of my artistry, if you will, the kind of very fun comedic stage side, and then sort of the very quiet, you know, Pandora type Jim of fall asleep to, you know, calming music that people really like.
Yeah. Right. So let's talk about this matter of the playing the piano backwards.
Yeah.
And I, you know, of course, I wish for this one moment, I wish we were on television so people could really see what we're talking about. And of course, if they haven't seen you, they very likely have maybe, but otherwise you can certainly go to YouTube and find all kinds of examples of this where you are seated at the piano, but the piano is behind you instead of in front of you, and your piano, your hands, arms are stretched behind you, and you are somehow playing the entertainer, not missing a note. When was the first time you attempted that? And do you remember what piece of music you used the first time you just tried to do that? And what in the world prompted you to try something so crazy?
So it actually was The Entertainer, as people know as the Ice Cream Truck song. That was the original song that I learned, and I've done a few others, but I still love to perform The Entertainer as kind of that the song for that. It was for a talent show, so it was actually kind of a summer church youth camp that I was going to, and they had a big talent show, and it's like I wanted to do that, and so I had the chance to. It was a big event. I mean, they had over almost 1,500 kids that were, you know, attending this this summer camp, and so I worked for. I actually went the first year, and I saw the talent show, and I thought that's so cool. I want to do that. So I went home that summer, and then I spent months, you know, developing that routine, and I'd heard of people doing things at the piano, and I can't recall if I'd actually ever seen anybody go upside down, but I'd never seen the backwards thing. That's something that I'd never seen anybody do. And in fact, since then, it's extremely rare. I don't know of any other commercial artists who do that. There may be somebody out there. There's some people on YouTube, but there's really nobody commercially that actually plays behind their back. And then the pedaling with the head, that's the thing that nobody does that.
Right.
And in fact, when the Ellen Show invited me to come and perform, they were like, you know, we saw a couple people play the piano behind their back, but we never saw anybody else with pedals on the ground, you know, and they were just like, that's awesome. And so they wanted me on the show. But anyway, that was for a talent show, and a lot of work, especially in the transitions, because it's when you go from sitting at the piano to sitting, you know, that I'm there with my hands behind my back, that transition took quite a bit of learning to not miss a note, as you said, and not kind of have to pause the song. And but it's just, it's so fun now. And in fact, you know, over the years, it's morphed a little bit, because I've had circumstances where I perform it where people can't see the piano very well. You know, sometimes, I mean, you try to have the ideal circumstance, but I do a lot of corporate events, and sometimes it's just set up where somebody can't actually see me. And so what I've started doing is I actually hit the pedal a little harder with my head, so that way the people, if they can't see me pedaling with my head, they hear it. Mm-hmm. And so it's like it amplifies the comedy, because they're sitting there and they hear this, you know, bunk, bunk, bunk as my head keeps hitting the bell. And I hope I don't have a concussion someday from this, but
well,
it's fun.
What we're going to do is we will listen to you playing The Entertainer. And even though people can't see you do this, they will hear this seamless performance. And I'm just going to chime in here as you're playing and saying, and now he's backwards. And now he's sitting on the floor on his back, and they won't hear any interruption whatsoever. So I hope people will get at least some sense of the magic that you do. So here we go. And he's backwards. He's sitting backwards on the bench. And he just turned around, and he's playing frontwards now. And now he's down on his knees, still playing. And now he's on his back, not missing a note. And now he's pedaling with his head. And now Now he's back standing and playing frontwards. And the crowd is cheering, and Ellen is shaking her head in wonderment. So what a great moment for you, Jason Lyle Black. Some kind of talent moment, I guess, on Ellen. So we're going to also play an example of one of your YouTube videos that has had huge attention. It involves actually a video in which you are not seen very much at all on screen, but it's something that you put together with your own grandparents. Tell us about this.
So my grandparents, I do come from a musical family. I'm the only one that has pursued it as a career, but my mom is a very talented flutist, and her parents are both very talented pianists, and my grandpa is actually an organist as well. So I kind of grew up around that, and I grew up watching my grandparents play duets together at our family reunions. Scott Joplin was music they'd often do. And so anyway, I got to this point where I said, well, I'd love to make a video of a love story of a couple to Disney music. And I reached out to my grandparents and said, I need to cast an 80-year-old couple in a video. Is there any chance you might want to do this? And my grandparents are very private people. And so I thought, they probably want to do it, but I want to give them the first invitation. And they said, oh, we'd love to. So bless my grandma's heart, the day we brought this film equipment into their home, and she's just like, oh, I've never been in a music video. she's seeing all these lights getting set up in their front room, and we're basically turned their house into the – tried to turn it into the scene from Up. And so I worked with a friend, Eric Thane, from Celadora Studios, and worked with him on the concept, and then I kind of wrote the storyboard and screenplay and basically pulled in all of the props. And so you'll see the cane with the four tennis balls from Up, and you see the glasses, and you see the adventure book and the house and all these kind of the dog and all these things. We really tried to recreate Up, and then did it as part of my grandparents' anniversary celebration. And so it was just so neat, and they've touched so many people around the world. I've had messages from Indonesia and from the Philippines and from Europe. And I had phone calls from television producers around the world and from national news media. As I said, the Good Morning America and Today Show and Yahoo and Huffington Post, and all these folks were calling me about wanting to know their story. And it's just really cool to see the impact that music has in the world for good. The people who have – who would sit there and say, this is my goal in 60 years. I want to be them, and people really long for that. The world is kind of – the families kind of are, not staying together. And people love seeing this idea of loyalty and marriage. And it's just – so for on a lot of fronts, both for my family – it's a family treasure for our family now, for all of my cousins and aunts and uncles to have this memory of my grandparents who, as I said, they're now in their mid-80s. They're up there in age, and we're just grateful for them and for their love of music and love of each other and the great example that they've set.
We're just going to play a few moments of this video so people can hear it. So there is a house and the various props that people might remember, very similar to the opening sequence from the film Up, but this is actually Jason Lyle Black's grandparents. And there's even a little booklet that's like a picture album of their adventures together. And his grandpa is sitting down at the piano and begins playing. And his grandmother in the kitchen hears this and comes into the living room. And up on the wall is a little banner that says 60 years. How sweet is this? Nearly 2 million views of this beautiful little video.
Over 2 million on YouTube, and then about another 20 million on Facebook.
Wow. So people should seek this out on YouTube, which is where I have it. Pixar's Up in Real Life is the title.
Search
of
Up
it.
In Real Life. In fact, yeah. Disney themselves even shared this video, and Hal Leonard, who I'm based here, they've published the arrangement, and it's in fact, Disney, about a year later, they put out a video called Doug in Real Life with the dog from Up. And he would go talk to kids in a park and would say, my name's Doug. I like you. Let's be friends. And I just can't help but wonder if this video inspired Disney to say, hey, we could go do this with the dog.
Absolutely. Well, that's a real treasure. It just shows another facet of your many talents. Well, and I know you are off to an elementary school in just a few minutes, but Eric, say a quick word about what Jason is going to be doing tomorrow night.
Sure, absolutely. So tomorrow night will be a very intimate house concert with a variety of things that Jason will be doing. It actually begins at 6:45 at Jeff Neubauer's house with some pre-concert music by Young Strings, and I'm sorry I don't remember the three people. Matt Piper is one of the violinists that I do remember. Very talented local high school kids are playing for about 45 minutes beforehand during wine and hors d'oeuvres, and then Jason will present about a 60 to 75 minute show. Again, in their living room at their wonderful Steinway Grand, and then there'll be desserts and coffee after that.
So what do people do if...
The center of her policy, this historic, steadfast U.S. relationship.
So what do people do if they want to secure a ticket for tomorrow night's concert?
Well, great question. They can get tickets at Racine Theater Guild. They are $75, and it is a benefit for the Guild. And you can also go to jasonlyleblack.com/tickets2017 and purchase a ticket online and just print your receipt and bring that with you, and that's valid. And then there's another concert on Thursday night at Waterford High School. You can also get those tickets at that same web address that I mentioned. And that's at Waterford High School at 7 p.m., and that's a benefit for their music department. At 6 p.m., Jason will be doing a pre-concert talk, which we did the last time he was here, and everyone just loved that. It was, again, a very intimate thing. He answered questions and demonstrated a little bit of what he does, and we're looking forward to that as well.
Fantastic. So best wishes with all of these performances coming up in the next few days. Jason Lyle Black, it was great to reconnect with you. And, of course, people can seek out your albums on iTunes and other places.
And Pandora, Spotify, Apple Music. Like I said, Piano Preludes is my most recent album, and it's actually piano and strings, so something that's really, really calming and beautiful to listen to. And
well, we all need that.
If I can add something to that, Jason also has all his music published, several different books, probably four different music books. So if you're a piano player and want to seek out to play some of his arrangements, you can find those outlets.
Very good. Well, Jason Lyle Black, great to reconnect, and
Thanks, best wishes
with this burgeoning career of yours. We
appreciate
have a feeling it's only going to go up from here, and we hope that all kinds of other wonderful opportunities come your way. And thank you for making part of the morning show part of your busy schedule for these couple days you're in Southeast Wisconsin.
Hey, thanks for having us.
And Eric, thanks
appreciate
for helping to make this happen.
My pleasure. Thanks for having us, Greg.
The time is 8:33. Here's part two of today's morning show here on WGTD. You're about to hear the story of a man and some children in the nation of Nepal, and of the wonderful bond which developed between them, and of the mission which he found himself pursuing against all odds. The gentleman in question, Connor Grennan, who at the age of 29 drastically changed gears in his life and undertook some volunteer work at an orphanage in war-torn Nepal. And it was something which he did almost as sort of a lark, in a sense, and it instead became something tremendously meaningful to him and the start of a beautiful new life. And also, as I said, a mission in which he was determined to reunite some of these orphans, who in fact were not orphans at all, with their parents, and to reverse some terrible injustices which had brought such disarray to the lives of innocent children in Nepal. This story is told in a brand new book which is called Little Princes, One Man's Promise to Bring Home the Lost Children of Nepal. And this book is part of an organization, in a sense, called Next Generation Nepal, a nonprofit organization. And some of the proceeds from the sale of this book support the work of that organization. This is a publication of William Morrow. Connor Grennan, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thanks for having me, Greg.
I wonder if you could just say a word about Connor Grennan before this book begins, or I mean, before we, in a sense, meet you. I mean, growing up, what kind of a young man were you, and would we have seen any hints of what was to come?
Yeah, that's a good question. I hadn't really thought about it, but, you know, I grew up in Poughkeepsie, New York, which is, you know, a suburb a couple hours north of New York. But then when I was 10, ended up moving to a very poor neighborhood in Jersey City, New Jersey, across the river from New York City. And, you know, so I think that I got pretty toughened up, and I saw some stuff that, you know, probably 10-year-olds, you know, shouldn't really see, but too many have to see. But, you know, after that, I don't know if there was, like, a lot of inkling into what would happen later in my life. Certainly, I didn't feel it. I felt like, you know, if I can be brutally honest here, pretty self-centered. And I don't say that ironically or anything. I just didn't have any desire to, you know, kind of go outside my own life to volunteer to do anything else.
So you were caught up in your own stuff, whatever that was.
Yeah, you know, and I'd done a lot of traveling. I mean, after I graduated from University of Virginia in 96, I ended up going to Prague and to Brussels. So I lived abroad for 8 years and did a lot of traveling. So, you know, I wasn't afraid of that. I think I was more just afraid of children in general.
Hmm. The work you did in Prague was for the East-West Institute, a public policy think tank. And you liked it, but after 8 years, you tell us you were bored and desperately in need of some kind of radical change. So what did you want to do at that point?
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, I'd spent 8 years in this world. I loved it. But, you know, after 8 years, I think we all need some kind of change. And I didn't know what I wanted to do, but I did discover about myself that at that point in my life, money wasn't really bringing me much happiness. And I don't mean that in any kind of strange communist way or anything. It just wasn't the source of it. But whereas adventures sort of were. So I decided to do something which I thought was pretty radical, which was just to take all the money I'd saved and spend it on a year-long trip around the world to try to reboot a little bit. And I had always thought that I wouldn't get married, I wouldn't have kids, so I would always just come back and make more money.
Hmm. So ahead of this trip around the world, something motivates you to do a little stint of volunteer work. It's kind of interesting, the sort of the central reason behind your decision. Why did you want to do this sort of altruistic volunteer stint ahead of this trip around the world?
Yeah, you know, I told all my friends that I was going around the world, and I expected them to kind of, you know, cheer me on and say, yeah, that's so great. And instead, I found that they were actually much more responsible than I thought, and they said, you know, are you really going to spend all your money doing this and go through all these countries and not even volunteer? And I realized that I would probably have to do some kind of volunteer work in the beginning just to kind of get everybody off my back. And then when I was trying to, you know, think about where I would go, I discovered that if I said, you know, something really extreme, for example, an orphanage in Nepal, you know, the girls' eyes lit up, you know, like women in bars kind of swooned a little bit. So I discovered it was a great pickup line, and that kind of cemented my decision.
Hmm. So tell us about what it felt like to enter a nation like Nepal. I mean, drastically different, I should think, from a place like Prague, a beautiful cosmopolitan city.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's really, you know, Nepal is one of the absolute poorest countries in the world. I mean, it's a real shock to the senses, even coming out of the airport. Incredible poverty everywhere. There's just, you know, trash and everything else everywhere. And it's, but, you know, you sort of start to realize that this is just a place where people live. You know, I think that one of the big shocks to me was that I knew that there was a civil war going on out there, but I kind of assumed that it wasn't really much of a civil war. It was sort of like the Basque separatists or something like that. And I got out there and, you know, was confronted with tanks and soldiers with guns and everything else. And I just knew immediately off the bat that, you know, I sort of started wondering whether I'd made a big mistake by going out there.
Hmm. I think it says a lot about your sort of attitude going in that the way you describe it is you went through the orientation session and were being told a lot of important information about what to do, what not to do in a place like Nepal. You were barely paying attention, and you're probably not unique in as an American making that kind of mistake.
Yeah, you know, I think that's probably true, unfortunately. You know, it was just one of these things where I knew that I was going to be volunteering for a couple months. But I got to tell you, my heart just wasn't really in it. I had come to Nepal to trek, really, and so I had already done that. And my mind was probably more on, you know, the beaches in Thailand that I was going to be going to in, a few months later.
So tell us about this place called the Little Prince's Children's Home, where you were to do your main volunteer work and would ultimately become the emotional center of your life.
Well, at that time, what we knew about the Little Prince's Children's Home was that, you know, it was part of a, you know, they were sending some volunteers there, and I was fortunate to be able to go there. It was in a small village called Gadauri, which is just a little south of Kathmandu, but still in the Kathmandu Valley. And, you know, all we knew is that there were 18 kids who were supposedly orphans from the war, who came from a very remote part of the country, up in the far northwest part, right on the border with Tibet. And I got in there not really knowing what it would be like to work with kids, let alone orphans in Nepal, and I expected them all to be kind of sad, sitting around in corners like you see on TV. And I got in there, and they all just kind of jumped on me. They were probably the happiest kids I've ever met in my life, between the ages of about 5 and maybe 12 years old. So I was caught off guard completely.
And you certainly come up with a fascinating image of what it was like to sort of figure things out on the fly. You write, as it turns out, wondering what you're supposed to do in an orphanage is like wondering what you're supposed to do at the running of the bulls in Spain. You work it out pretty quickly.
Yeah.
And in fact, that seems to be the way it worked for you. And this turned out to be a pretty natural fit for you.
You know, much to the shock of not just me, but I think all my family and friends, you know, I really just got very, very attached to these kids. And I wouldn't be surprised to find that everybody got attached to the kids in that situation. I mean, you're really out there just living with them and taking care of them. But they were just wonderful little kids. It was overwhelming at first, but then you realize you just try to keep up with them, and that becomes your new life.
Hmm. I thought it was so interesting. I think this is worth talking about for a moment. You tell us that as you walked up to the main metal gate that led into the Little Prince's Children's Home, you write, "I hadn't realized until that moment how much I did not want to walk through that gate. What I wanted was to tell people I had volunteered in an orphanage. Now that I was actually here, the whole idea of my volunteering in this country seemed ludicrous." But I think that's so striking. I don't think that's uncommon at all for somebody to sort of be infatuated with the idea of doing something like this. But when it comes to the nitty-gritty reality of actually doing it, that's another thing altogether, and that seems to have been what you weren't really prepared for.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, and I think that there's more people in this situation than let on, but I hope that I'm very upfront in the book by just saying, it's exactly that. I got there, and I wasn't the kind of person that volunteered, but I wanted to be the kind of person that volunteered, if that makes sense. You know, I wanted to be that guy who had that passion and who everybody looked up to and everybody thought was this altruistic guy and everything else. But in fact, my motivations for volunteering were, you know, I could put something on my resume maybe. You know, I could sort of use it as a pickup line in bars. And, you know, I suspect that maybe there's other people like that out there. You know, I don't want to presume. But I did find mostly that even if you don't want to do this, it's taking that first step that makes the difference. So even if you don't have that passion, and I think a lot of us maybe don't have that passion, or that we don't have that skill, or we don't have that innate sense that we have to help other people, even if you don't have that, and I certainly didn't, if you just take that first step and go out and just start volunteering, unbelievably, that gives you the passion, and that gives you the compassion for other people, and that starts to give you the skill. So I find that, you know, in the world, we're working backwards a lot when we think about volunteering.
We're speaking with Connor Grennan, and we're talking about his book, Little Princes, One Man's Promise to Bring Home the Lost Children of Nepal. You've already mentioned that Nepal was, and I suspect still is, one of the poorest countries in the world. And one of the reasons that life is so difficult there and why so many people in Nepal live in such terrible poverty is because it has been a country racked by terrible, violent civil war. And unfortunately, it has sometimes been innocent children most brutally caught in the crossfire of that, sometimes literally and certainly figuratively. describe first for a moment this Civil War unrest that I've just mentioned, and then specifically how that would so dramatically impact the lives of children, such as the children at the Little Prince's Children's Home.
Yeah, you know, and just to sort of so that your listeners understand, I didn't know anything about this war going in. I barely knew Nepal was a country going in, and people always say, oh, I wish I should have known more about this. I don't think so. It's a tiny country on the other side of the world. But so what happened was in 1996, this revolution started. The Civil War went about 10 years, from 96 to 2006. And there was just a bunch of sort of Maoists that decided that they were going to overthrow the king. And they, you know, started in these small little villages. And the way that this can happen and start to spread so quickly is that Nepal is incredibly cut off. I mean, one of my favorite statistics that I've heard, I think it's true, is that 80% of goods in Nepal are transported by foot. There's simply no roads. And so, you know, you can imagine if something takes hold, there's no police, there's no army to go off into these incredibly remote villages where there's no roads, no electricity, no phones leading in or out. And that movement just started to grow and grow and grow, and the king tried to ignore it at first, but eventually couldn't. And probably by about 2003, 2004, the Maoists had essentially taken over the entire country except for the Kathmandu Valley. So that's how the Civil War went. But, you know, the problem, as you mentioned, Greg, is that the kids are really the ones caught in this. And the reason for that is that as soon as the Maoists start running out of adults to join the army, then they turn to the children, as happens so often in the world. And not just sort of the children who can carry rifles, but the very young children, 5, 6, 7 years old, because they're the ones that can boil water and they're the ones that can, you know, clean the guns and everything else. And so what the Maoists started to do in these very remote regions is they just started to abduct one child per family. That was the policy for these villagers. And there was no rule of law. There was no police or anything except the Maoists. And they had no choice. And it got so brutal that the Maoists, you know, got impatient. And they would just literally walk into schools. And they would murder the teachers and just collect 80 kids and bring them into the army. So parents were obviously just in a desperate situation out there.
There is a day at the Little Prince's Children's Home when a strange man, I mean, he was strange to you at least, appeared. You'd never seen him before. And when you found out later who he was and what he did, this had to be one of the most appalling moments for you in your whole time in Nepal. Tell us about this man named Golka.
Yeah, this whole story was just unbelievable. I had no idea what was going on, and I would just combine that with another thing to find. When we found out that these kids weren't orphans, but this man, Golka, turned out to be a trafficker. He turned out to be the guy that had taken all these children from this very remote region called Humla on the border of Tibet in the first place. He had taken them from the mountains. And we were just stunned to learn that these kids had just gone through so much. But we were even more stunned when we learned that, you know, when this woman came down the path, and she turned out to be the mother of two of the children in the children's home. And this was unbelievable because we thought this was impossible. Of course, all the children were supposed to be orphans. And she told us the story of really how Golka worked and how the trafficking worked, and we were just blown away.
So tell us what he did and why.
Well, so what would happen is that, you know, as if you can imagine in these very remote regions, when the parents are, you know, just clinging to their children, knowing that at some point the rebels are going to come and knock on the door and take their 5-year-old, 6-year-old, 7-year-old son or daughter away, they're in these incredibly desperate situations. And so then one day this man, Golka, who, you know, his brother was a kind of a politician in the region, so he was trusted in that region. He came through and he said, look, I can help save your child. What I can do is I have access to be able to bring your child into the Kathmandu Valley, which is the one safe place left in Nepal. It's the one place that the king still had control over. And what I can do is I can take them there and I can give them an education because there's no schools left here, and I can save them from the Maoist rebels, and I can essentially raise them for the next 10 years. Now, you know, this was, of course, a dream come true for parents. However, it was going to cost them, you know, an arm and a leg. And in fact, what they had to do is they had to sell their home and they had to sell their land. And this is in a place where you only had your home and only had your land. These are subsistence farmers. But, you know, as all the parents out there will probably easily understand, there's no price too great to save your child. And so they did this. They went into debt for the rest of their lives. They would, you know, move in with neighbors. And they would be given a phone number by Golka. And he said, look, give me a call in, you know, 2 or 3 months and you can check on your child. And so they would take this number and, you know, be sad that their child was going away. But then, you know, maybe a couple months later, the father would go to the phone. Now, remember, the phone is probably 3 or 4 days' walk from where he was. that he would get there and just try to call and realize there was no answer. And the part that always guts me now as a father is to understand that this guy, this father, having left his wife 4 days earlier, kind of, and his wife is expecting him to come back with happy news of, you know, how their son is safe, has to make that long 4 or 5 day walk home to his wife, knowing that he's going to go home to tell his wife that their son or daughter is just gone. And Golka would essentially drop these kids in Kathmandu. Sometimes they would just lock them in a room, maybe twice the size of your bedroom, put about 20 kids in there, keep them alive on a bowl of rice a day so that there's not, you know, not too many actual deaths, because that could sort of cause a little bit of commotion with the authorities. And then, you know, he would send them out to beg. He would send them out to go to tourists and say, hey, you know, collect money for this quote-unquote orphanage. He would make more money that way. Sometimes they would even, you know, forge the death certificates for the parents and put them up for illegal adoption. And in a country where it's, you know, $250 is the standard annual salary, he could make maybe $5,000 on that. And so basically this trafficker is just making money hand over fist from these young kids.
Your time in Nepal comes to an end. It was it a 3 month or a 4 month volunteering stint?
Yeah, the first time was 3 months, and then I went back after my around the world trip for another 3 months just to sort of see the kids again.
Right, and in that time, the civil war had gotten actually gotten worse.
Yep.
And this was a really frightening time as you returned, because there was the very real possibility that these children in the Little Princess Children's Home might be taken by the Maoists.
Well, you know, it was a really terrible time for us, because we came back, and I was there in, you know, the beginning of 2006. As you're saying, the war was getting worse, and the Maoists said, look, basically, we're going to start coming into Kathmandu now, and we're going to put an end to this. We're going to, you know, bring all the people out on the street. And they did, and I was sort of fortunate to get, you know, one of the last flights out before the revolution hit. And we, you know, we left our 18 kids in the care of, you know, the local staff, which didn't worry us too much. I knew that they were good. The real problem, Greg, was that we had found seven other children. And they were, you know, seven children that Golka had trafficked and abandoned in the shack, basically. And we were just going and keeping them alive, you know, with rice and everything else. And we found a children's home that could go and pick them up. And we found it just days before I had to sort of flee the country. And we felt incredibly fortunate. And I got back to New York thinking, okay, well, you know, we've at least saved those seven kids. And then the revolution took place. You know, the protesters were out on the street, and the king ordered them all to shot. And so soldiers literally came out in the street and just started shooting protesters dead on the street. And that's when the revolution really took hold. And if you were watching CNN in April of 2006, you would have seen Nepal all over the news. And essentially, you know, after 2 weeks, the king was overthrown, and kind of peace actually reigned in Nepal. And this orphanage went to go pick up those seven children and found that they were gone. And Golka had learned that they were going to go pick them up and had beaten them to the kids, and by maybe 48 hours, and the kids were now just completely disappeared. And I got an email when I was back in New York saying that the kids were gone. And I said, well, what can you go find them? And people said, well, not really. I mean, you know, Kathmandu is too chaotic. There's too many kids here. You know, these kids are just disappeared. Mm.
So this became your new mission.
Yeah, absolutely.
As you return to Nepal. And somewhere along the way, you encounter the mother of one of the children of the Little Prince's Children's Home. And this is an amazing, eye-opening moment for you, as you probably in the most concrete sort of way realize that at least some of these children are not orphans at all. They have families. They have parents. And tell us about the mission which overtook you at this point.
Well, it was just amazing to have lived with these kids for many months. And young kids who we were now very, very close with. And to have them telling us, you know, over and over again that they were orphans and to never doubt it was one thing. And then when this mother showed up at the orphanage, and so we knew at least two of the kids weren't orphans, and the really strange thing about this was that the two kids were scared that their mother had showed up. And we couldn't figure that out until we realized that, you know, the trafficker, Golka, had taught them never to tell anybody that they had parents, and if they did tell anybody, they would get beaten. And so they were afraid that we were going to beat them. I mean, it was just really incredible because, you know, then they wouldn't be able to raise as much money from tourists and everything if they actually had parents. And as we dug a little deeper, we realized that almost all of them had parents. Now, the parents were so cut off, they were in this, you know, they might as well be on the other side of the moon. You know, on the other side of Nepal, deep in the mountains, that there was simply nothing we could do. But when we learned that they actually had families, and I was, you know, I decided nobody else is going to do this work. And, you know, again, I wasn't the kind of person that was, you know, set out to go, you know, do this for these kids or anything else. But the problem was nobody else was doing it. And so I realized if I didn't do it, nobody would do it. And these kids are, you know, wonderful kids. And so basically with Next Generation Nepal, which is a small organization I started when I was back in New York, I decided that first I had to come back and I had to track down those seven children, you know, wherever they were in Kathmandu. And the second thing was that I had to go find those families. Hmm.
One of the things you tell us is that in the work you did in Nepal, you had to learn a kind of patience, a kind of patience in Nepal that did not come naturally to you.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It was, I mean, you know, as an American, I'm sort of, not to make a sweeping generalization, but just to speak for myself, I'm just incredibly impatient. You know, I you know, if things aren't happening, I kind of want to make them happen, and I never want to have a spare down moment or anything. But when I actually started to go and look for the families of these kids, especially, I just realized it would take time. And I mean, so I flew as deep into the mountains as I could and put on a backpack, and I was impatient to get to the villages, but there was no way to do it except just to walk, and I just had to walk. And then, you know, there were times where I just had to wait for a family, and I would just sit there for hours and hours and hours. And then, you know, it sort of really saved my life probably when I thought that I was waiting for a helicopter on the top of this mountain, and it just never came. And, you know, the old Connor would have gone probably literally insane over the course of 5 days, but, you know, I had learned that patience.
Connor Grennan is able to reunite many, many children, so-called orphans, with their parents, and shares many, many moving accounts of those reunions in his remarkable book, which again is called Little Princes, One Man's Promise to Bring Home the Lost Children of Nepal, published by William Morrow. Tomorrow on The Morning Show, three different interviews. The first will be with best-selling author Andrew Carroll. He is one of the country's leading authorities on war letters, and he has done a great deal to see that a number of war letters from just about every major conflict in which the United States has been involved have been preserved, going all the way back to the Revolutionary War. Andrew Carroll's most recent book is called My Fellow Soldiers, and it tells the story of General John Pershing and of the crucial role that American soldiers played in the First World War. And much of the book is based upon recently discovered letters that General Pershing wrote home to his family. It's an extraordinary book. In part two of tomorrow's morning show, you'll hear from Suzanne Gordon, who has written and lectured extensively on various topics related to healthcare. And her latest book is about the healthcare that we deliver to our veterans. In part three of tomorrow's morning show, I will replay a lively conversation with the author of a book called Wrigley Field, looking back at the long and colorful history of perhaps the most iconic ballpark in professional baseball, Wrigley Field, the home of the Chicago Cubs. On Thursday, Dr. Art Sear joins me from Carthage College's Clawson Center to offer his reflection on current events, including his reflection on the first 100 days of the presidency of Donald Trump. On Friday, among other things, we will preview for you this weekend's performances of the delightful comedy The Barber of Seville by Gioachino Rossini. I'll be speaking with two talented gentlemen who are part of the cast of The Barber of Seville, which opens Friday night. The Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. The program is archived on our website, wgtd.org. We want to remind you that Wisconsin Public Radio's spring membership drive is now underway. And if you are a listener to WGTD, if you enjoy the programming that you hear, including programs like The Morning Show, then it's really crucial that you support Wisconsin Public Radio, because without them, we simply would not be here, and what we do would not be possible. You can donate anytime during the fundraiser, either online at WPR.org or on the phone at 1-888-202-2552, 1-888-202-2552. And please